Okay, welcome everybody. This is the third lecture of Econ 400, Mises on Money and Banking. In this particular lecture, the title we gave it is Money and Its Enemies, but actually most of the lecture tonight is going to focus on the earlier chapter, which talks about the classification scheme of money. So here's the outline, and for those of you just joining us, once again for this week, you definitely want to get the PowerPoint and have that on your hard drive because there's a lot of information I put in there regarding these two chapters that we're covering. If I don't say that, that's probably going to be true for all the PowerPoints for this particular class. All right, so a lot of material, so why don't we jump right in here. Mises, in the beginning of the first chapter that we're covering for this lecture, he spends a lot of time discussing whether, or I should say, how to classify money. And this is, I would encourage you not to get discouraged by this, because if you just, and this is what I mean about this class, where for some of you, depending on your, ability to comprehend difficult passages and your familiarity with some of the writers and the concepts that Mises is referring to here, you might just give up on this chapter, and it would be a shame if you did. So let me try to give you a little encouragement to try to help you get through it, because what Mises does here is really astounding. I mean, he is, just in terms of the scholarship he displays, that he, what he's trying to do, just to give you the big picture, is he's trying to figure out how do we classify money. And we'll see the way he does it, he walks the reader, and he's trying to persuade the reader, right? So Mises came up with his own conclusion, and now he's trying to convince the reader, this is, you know, look at the arguments on both sides of this issue. And so Mises is showing his command of the literature. But then beyond that, he like walks you through and says, this is what this guy said, this is what this guy said. But then he said this in response, but that's not a good answer because blah, 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 blah. And this is where I come down, Mises says. And moreover, this is relevant. This isn't just some mere academic squabble with no consequences. We're going to see, so I'm still talking on Mises' behalf, what he's saying to his reader. We're going to see in part three of this book why this is so relevant, why we're worrying about all this apparent, you know, pedantic classification and just, you know, sort of putting things in boxes, who cares. We're going to see the relevance of this in part three if you'll just stick with me. That's what he's telling the reader. So that's it really, you don't see this in human action, okay? By the time you get to human action, usually Mises is sort of just, you know, like Mises is going to say what his worldview is, and then he might entertain objections, which you can tell the people who are objecting to him he thinks are crazy. Not crazy, but they're like evil opponents, you know what I mean? And he's blowing them up because this is important for civilization, to blow up these people who are objecting to the views I'm expounding here. Whereas in theory, money and credit, look at this chapter, for example, it's not like the fate of civilization hangs on the balance here. It's just this is a question of economic theory. How do we classify money in this framework that economists developed to be applicable to direct exchange? Now that we've got this thing of money, where what do we do with it? And it's really neat to see how Mises as a scholar approaches this question, not least of which because, as we'll see, he disagrees with Bumbavrik, right? That Mises walks through, and he, you know, pays his respects to the great master and everything, but Mises basically says, no, Bumbavrik was wrong on this, and here's why. So it's just really, for people who think that Austrian economics is just a bunch of ideology and dogmatism, I mean, this chapter really shows that that's not at all the case, that Mises is a scientist to the extent that you think an economist can be a scientist, right? I mean, he really is just going through and, you know, looking at the work that everyone else has done up till that point, summarizing it, and then showing, nope, this position is right. So anyway, let me try to now give you the specifics, but I just kind of wanted to give you a little pep talk and a reason for why should you roll your sleeves up and try to get through this. All right, so knowing that it really isn't all that hard. Okay, I don't want to scare you away and make you think that, oh, no, there's no way I'm going to understand this. It really isn't, but it's the writing is more difficult than even the writing in Human Action, because, again, partly because Mises is here writing for other economists. He's not writing Theory of Money and Credit for the layperson. Okay, so what's going on in this specific controversy in the beginning of this chapter? He wants to answer the question, how do we classify money? So before economists, I was going to say before they knew about money, of course they knew about money, before their theoretical structures dealt with money, you know, originally you're just thinking in terms of direct exchange, or not even exchange at all. You're just thinking in terms of the classification of goods, and you're thinking of, okay, there's scarcity, people have preferences, and then they start economizing. And so in a Mengerian framework, oh, you come up with the notion of what is a good, right? It's a, you know, an object that can satisfy human wants, but it's scarce, that you can't, there are not enough units of this particular object to satisfy all of the wants that could be satisfied with something of this kind, or, you know, I'm obviously loosely paraphrasing here. So you have to devote units of it to the most important ends and so forth. All right, so that's what a good is. And then, well, what's a consumption good? Well, a consumption good is one that directly satisfies wants for some actor. And then what's a production good? Well, a production good doesn't directly satisfy any wants, but we can use it to produce consumption goods or to produce other production goods, which in turn can produce consumption goods. Okay, so so that's, okay, we have a general idea of what consumption goods are and production goods, and that seemed to be an exhaustive classification, right? Among all the class of all goods, it seems like you should be able to divide them into one category or the other, either production goods or consumption goods. What else could it be? And that's the issue. So Mises says, if that's the way you're approaching it, then, yeah, money has to be a producer good or a production good. Clearly, money is not a consumption good. Now, let me pause here for a minute. I just realized something that might be confusing you. And surprisingly, I don't think Mises ever explicitly says what I'm about to tell you in this chapter. Normally, he's pretty good about making a disclaimer or a caveat like this, but I don't remember him saying it in this chapter. Anyway, what is it? The disclaimer is, here we're talking about money, the money good, the money commodity, qua money. And qua is Q-U-A, just the fancy way of saying, you know, as. So for the rest of this lecture, and when you're reading Mises in this chapter, when he says things like money is clearly not a consumer good, you can't get all mixed up and say, wait a minute, but if money happens to be gold, and people are using gold as a jewelry, well, of course that's, you know, you're making a nice necklace and you give it to your girlfriend. That's a consumer good, certainly not a production good. What the heck is he talking? He doesn't mean that. He means the gold that's being used as money, the gold that is serving right now as a medium of exchange, that is clearly not a consumption good. That's what he means, right? So money could turn, the money commodity could turn into a consumer good. But at that moment, that particular thing wouldn't be money. It would be a necklace. See what I'm saying? And then if all of a sudden you decided to view it as, no, well, no, actually, I'm going to use this as money now because, you know, I've got a hard time. I'm going to take this thing and trade it away as a medium of exchange. Well, then it's not a consumer good anymore. Now it's back to being money. See, so just Mises didn't spell that out in this chapter, but that's what he means. So, and there's going to be some other things we're going to do later on in this particular lecture talking about, for example, that society isn't wealthier if the quantity of money increases. But clearly, Mises, when he says stuff like that, he means considering it as money. Obviously, society's wealthier if we get more gold and silver because we can use them for their other applications. Okay, so now back to this original issue here. So Mises is saying, if your framework as an economist divides the class of goods up into two exhaustive categories, namely consumer goods and producer goods, well, then money has to be a producer good. That's the only box that it makes sense to put it into. However, he's saying that's actually not the best way to go about it, that other economists had proposed, why don't we have a threefold classification scheme, namely producer goods, consumer goods, and media of exchange. And then if we do that, well, then obviously money goes into media of exchange, and that makes a lot more sense. Okay, so that's the issue, that, and that's what Mises is trying to referee, that dispute early on in this first of these two chapters that we're covering tonight, is he'll go through and he'll paraphrase or quote from some, you know, one economist who has this view, and then he'll quote somebody else who attacks it. And so it gets a little bit confusing with the back and forth, because Mises is going to let, like, the proponent of a view that Mises doesn't even agree with come up with a rejoinder, and then Mises is going to have to referee that. And okay, so that's, it gets a little bit, if you weren't completely sure going into it of what the different camps were and who believes what, you might get a little bit mixed up, because Mises, you know, he kind of just goes through it quickly, assuming the reader basically knows all this stuff. All right, so that's what's going on. So again, the point here is Mises is trying to convince the reader, to walk the reader through presumably the logic or the argument that Mises himself went through when he was trying to decide this issue. And so he's trying to show the reader, look, I'm being fair here, but I want to persuade you of, in this controversy, this one side really won the day, and here's why. Okay, before I move on, all right, so clearly it's not a consumer good. I don't think I need to convince you of that. But he said it's also not really a production good, because when you think about what is a producer good, it aids us in the physical production of consumer goods, or the physical production of other producer goods, which in turn, right? And so money doesn't really do that. Okay, so this next slide, when I say Mises enters the battle here, I've already touched on this. But again, here, the interesting thing is Mises is challenging Bombavark, right? So Bombavark thought that there were two categories of goods, and so naturally money has to be a producer good. So Mises is disagreeing with Bombavark on this issue. Okay, so now here's where it gets a little bit tricky. So those are the things, the two camps. So somebody who says, nah, money, it's clearly not a consumer good. Nobody thinks it's a consumer good. Bombavark says, oh, so it's got to be a producer good. And the economist who disagreed with that would say, no, Bombavark. Maybe they even called him Eugen, because they were friends with the guy. They say, no, Eugen, money is not a producer good. That doesn't really make sense, because look at what a producer good do. They help us to create consumer goods. Money doesn't do that, right? Like a seed. A tomato seed is a producer good, right? Because you put it in the ground and you fertilize it and put water in it, and boom, it produces tomatoes, produces consumer goods. So that's, right? The tractor is a producer good. It helps us make the seed. But the money that the consumer gives to the farmer for the tomato, that didn't really help make the tomato, right? That didn't really enter into the production process of the tomato. And, okay, so if you think about it, you could imagine a socialist society that didn't use money, but they would still use tomato seeds and tractors and stuff like that, right? Everything else that we consider to be producer goods. And so these are the types of arguments that Mises or other people could bring to bear to try to say, yeah, we totally see money's not a consumer good. Nobody thinks that. But you guys, even when you say money is a producer good, you're really straining that definition. You're only doing that because there's no other option in your limited framework with only two choices. So it makes more sense, instead of forcing money into this role of producer good, let's make up this third one, because really, think about it, money doesn't help us physically create stuff. So against that point of view, somebody like Bombavirk and others who said, no, money really is a producer good. What are you guys talking about? They came back, and that's what I'm getting at in this slide B here. And they said, what are you talking about? You guys are being very naive and literal in your definition of what a producer good has to be. That, yeah, money doesn't physically create a producer good. That's true. But by the same token, you know, a railroad that delivers the tomatoes from the farm to the grocery store 100 miles away, that doesn't physically make the tomato either, right? That just moves it around in space. So, you know, what are you guys talking about? That clearly the railroad is a producer good. You're not going to call that a transport good or something like that and make up a new category of goods. Clearly, things like railroads, cargo ships, even, you know, the safe in a bank or the, you know, a safe in a warehouse to keep goods from being stolen. I mean, those things are all producer goods. They're obviously not consumer goods, but they got to be something. They're producer goods, and there's no philosophical objection to calling them producer goods, even though in a sense they don't physically create stuff the way a seed does. But clearly those are producer goods. So your guys' objection to us putting money in the class of producer goods is a silly objection. Okay. So Mises is going to come back against that. And so this is what I'm saying. Like, Mises goes back and forth in this argument like 3 or 4 different times. And so I'm trying to make sure you see what the issue is. I see somebody asking if this is a typo. No, it's not a typo. I'm trying to say, when I say what about goods used in marketing, that there are goods that are not, in a sense, directly used in production. They're more used colloquially, like once the stuff is produced, then how do we bring it to market, right? So you can see how there's, on the one hand, there seems to be a qualitative difference between a tomato seed and fertilizer and a tractor contributing to the production of tomatoes versus the 18-wheeler that delivers the tomatoes to the grocery store. You could see how somebody might naively say the 18-wheeler isn't really involved in the production of tomatoes. That's just marketing. Okay, so Mises comes back, and he says, you guys are right. I'm not being naive. I agree with you. He wouldn't say 18-wheeler because I thought they had them back then, right? But the railroad, the cargo ship, the safes, the bullets in the gun of the security guy standing guard outside the warehouse, yes, those aren't consumption goods. Those are producer goods. And you're right. Economically speaking, those are higher order goods that contribute to the ultimate production of consumer goods just as surely as the fertilizer and the tractor and so on. And Mises pushes it further. And he says, because it's wrong to think that the farmer is doing something qualitatively different from what the guy driving the 18-wheeler is doing, or, you know, the guy operating the railroad. That the farmer isn't actually creating tomatoes from nothing. All the farmer does also is just, you know, rearrange matter that he starts to work with. Okay, so if you really push it philosophically or metaphysically or whatever adverb you want to use, what the farmer is doing with the fertilizer and the tractor and water and so forth and sunlight isn't different in terms of the production of tomatoes that are available to consumers 100 miles away in the grocery store. What the farmer does, his role in that process really is not qualitatively different from what the, you know, guy driving the 18-wheeler does. So if we're going to say that the fertilizer and the water and the tomato seeds are producer goods, that are higher order goods, where the lowest order good, the consumer good, is the tomato, you know, the ripe tomato that's in a package for the consumer to buy at the grocery store, well, then we also have to say the 18-wheeler and the labor of the guy driving it, those are producer goods too. Okay, so Mises is on board with that. He's saying, still, now that we understand that and we all agree, money does not really fit into that framework. Mises is saying there's something qualitatively different about money's role in that whole process. And he said the decisive observation, this the you know the critical thing that really should be a signal to us that money is not like any of the other things I just mentioned, is that if we had more of these other things, of the ships, the railroads, the safes, whatever, then society is richer. We are wealthier if we had more fertilizer, if we have more tomato seeds, we have more 18-wheelers. That makes us better off. But if we give the consumers more units of money with which, you know, they complete the transactions to buy the tomatoes at the, you know, at the end of the story here, that doesn't make us wealthier as a society. Okay, so that, Mises says, is the crucial distinction, and should really, and that's why it's inappropriate, or it would be ill-advised, unhelpful for us to try to stuff money into the category of a producer good, because there's something, you know, really different about money. Okay, so that's, now I just spent 20 minutes there walking you through that. Mises covers the ground I just covered in about 3 pages. Okay, but it's really an interesting back and forth, and you learn a lot of economic theory if you just walk through it slowly and unpack what Mises is saying there. So it's really just a fascinating thing to go through if you want to understand value theory from an Austrian perspective. Okay. Let's move on. Okay. Now this gets a little tricky here. Well, let me read this quote first, and then I'll elaborate on it. So the slide C, the big picture here is Mises is trying to, and this is the continuation of that last point. I don't think he says it in these words, but Rothbard later summarizes it like this to say, any quantity of money in a community is optimal in the sense, in its capacity as money, right? So a given medium of exchange, for its role as being a medium of exchange and allowing for indirect exchange to work, all the advantages that we derive from using money, we have that once there's enough money there's enough units of the thing to be money. Now that there's enough just to make it physically practical for this thing to serve as money for this community, if you double it, that doesn't make the community richer. Whereas that statement is not true for any other, or for any producer good, I should say. So that's, again, why Mises doesn't want to call money a producer good. So here's the quote now. No part of the total result of production is dependent on the collaboration of money, even though the use of money may be one of the fundamental principles on which the economic order is based. Right, so that's a very deep quote, and that's why I typed it up here. For those of you who have taken me in other classes, you know usually I just put up little goofy pictures, but some of these quotes I was just like, whoa, I got to make sure the people taking this class just catch the profundity of some of these things that Mises is sort of throwing aside here. All right, so this is a crucial point. Let me just make sure you get it. So Mises is saying, if we just, you know, you think about a modern industrial economy that, whatever, integrates the contributions of thousands of laborers and thousands of resource owners and so on, uses a bunch of capital goods that have been built up over the decades in order to raise a bunch of tomatoes, let's say, in this part of the country and ship them to a grocery store hundreds of miles away, nothing in that process needs the contribution of money in the same way that it needs the contribution of the fertilizer, of the seed, of the rainfall, of, well, not rain because that's a natural thing, but of the irrigation, let's say. The labor of the guy driving the 18-wheeler. All those things are necessary to bring, to have that production process work and bring the tomatoes finally to the grocery store. In principle, we can imagine a socialist society doing the same thing. So that's what Mises means in the first part of that sentence, that no part of the total result of production is dependent on the collaboration of money. But from that, we shouldn't conclude, oh, so money doesn't really do anything. No, then the second part of this quote, even though the use of money may be one of the fundamental principles on which the economic order is based. Okay, so again, this is a really deep thing, and on one hand, there's some sort of a tension here. It's like, if you remember last lecture, I was saying how it's interesting that Austrians simultaneously champion the subjectivity of preferences, and they take offense when, you know, somebody says something like a dollar means more to a poor man than to a rich man, and Austrians say, oh, subjective preferences. You can't make interpersonal utility comparisons, and yet Austrians also champion economic calculation and how we need market prices to be able to determine the correct allocation of scarce resources to do what? To serve the wishes of the consumer. And so that's kind of weird that if all the consumers have different preferences and we stomp the floor saying, don't you dare try to compare people's preferences, and then 2 minutes later we're saying how the market profit and loss test make sure that scarce resources go to where the consumers want them to go, that's a little bit weird, right? And so I'm not going to go over it again tonight, but that's part of the thing I was trying to spell out last lecture. So here there's a similar tension. On the one hand, there's a tradition within Austrian economics. Now, some have challenged it, by the way, like Walter Block and Bill Barnett don't like this. They think that, no, the market picks the optimal quantity of money. If the market decides to bring more money into existence, then that must mean the old amount was bad. Okay, so some Austrians challenge this, but Mises and Rothbard, sort of the standard orthodox modern Austrian view, is that any quantity of money is optimal in money's role as a medium of exchange, and yet the Austrians clearly believe the use of money is crucial for a modern economic order. So another way of seeing it is, isn't it weird that Mises, one of his arguments to try to show why money isn't a producer good, Mises refers to the socialist state to say under socialism, you know, you wouldn't need money in order to bring goods to market, but yet Mises also famously says there can be no rational calculation, you know, no efficient distribution of goods under socialism. So it's a little bit weird. It seems like Mises is almost using something that doesn't work in order to prove his point in this other debate. Okay, so the big scheme, I don't think there is a contradiction there. I'm just bringing this tension to the surface, and that's what Mises, at least through assertion, I mean, he doesn't really make the argument in this sentence, but in this sentence, he deals with both of those things. Okay. Maybe one way of seeing it is, this is the way that I kind of resolved at one time. When we say all quantities of money are optimal, that doesn't include zero, right? So if you go from having no money to having one unit of money, that's not what we mean when we say all, you know what I'm saying? So the point is, once money exists and people are using money and prices are quoted in terms of the money good, if you increase the quantity or decrease the quantity, but people can still use it as money and then prices just change, that's, you're not doing anything real. That's the insight. But like, if you destroyed so much of the money stock that you really couldn't use it as money anymore because it was impractical and they had to go use something else, or they had to go back to barter, well then yeah, that quantity of the money good is suboptimal because there's not enough of it. But that's not what we mean when we say all quantities of money are optimal. Okay. Now, again, I've got another long quote for you, but it's really important and impressive. So here's Mises talking about this threefold scheme now. So he says, the laws which govern the value of money are different from those which govern the value of production goods and from those which govern the value of consumption goods. This is a complete justification of the suggestion put forward by Nyes, I don't know how you pronounce that guy's name, that economic goods should be divided into means of production, objects of consumption, and media of exchange. For, after all, the primary object of economic terminology is to facilitate investigation into the theory of value. Okay, so let me, the fact that I dedicated a whole slide to this should show you, I think this is really important, but let me make sure you don't draw the wrong conclusion. So one important thing, in this particular quote that I just read, you'll notice the ellipsis. The three dots that I put in there, that's because I skipped a sentence. I didn't want to get the quote to be too long. Mises says something, I'm paraphrasing, but the part that I cut out here, he says something like, the only thing that these three different types of goods, that the laws which govern their value have in common is that they can all be derived from the fundamental law of value, or something like that, or the fundamental economic law of value. Okay, so don't be confused. Mises is not here saying that we have to have three different types of value theory. That's not what he's saying. Everything that Austrians can do or do is derived from the basic theoretical framework that Karl Menger established of subjective value theory, that people have ordinal preference rankings, and they can arrange their desired satisfactions from most important to least important. And then they can arrange units of various commodities in reference to that, those preferences to see what the importance on the margin is of every unit of every type of good out there. And so on that single unitary preference ranking would be producer goods, consumer goods, and media of exchange. Okay, so don't misunderstand. Mises is not saying people value producer goods in one part of their mind, and then over here they value consumer goods, and over here they value media of exchange, and those are those. We need to have, as economists, three different types of value theory to explain each of those worlds. That's not what Mises is saying. But what he is saying is, you know, we start with the fundamental laws of subjective value and how that works, but now as economists we can actually be a little bit more specific about how do people value producer goods, and how do people value consumer goods, and how they value media of exchange. Okay, so just to fill you in a little bit, what does he mean by that? So producer goods, well, let's start with consumer goods. Consumer goods, how does somebody evaluate those? Well, it's because of their ability to directly satisfy uneasiness or wants or desires or needs or whatever you want to call those subjective goals that people have. A consumer good directly satisfies those things. And so there you apply marginal utility to it, to that type of analysis. So you say, you know, what's the significance you attribute to one more unit of a particular consumer good? You say, well, with that, which of my currently unmet satisfactions can I satisfy? And then however important that satisfaction is to me, that's the importance I attribute now to that particular unit of that consumer good. That's the idea. What about producer goods? Well, producer goods, by definition, don't directly satisfy any of my goals, so clearly I can't use that same approach. Okay, so what we're doing here is, in terms of big picture subjective value theory, we say we rank things according to their significance to us. But then we now try to say, based on what kind of a good is it, give me a little more explanation about how do I determine that significance. That's kind of what's going on here. So consumer goods are pretty straightforward. Producer goods is a little less obvious because they don't directly satisfy any of our desires or goals. So how do we do it? Oh, well, here we use what later would be called marginal, well, I guess by Mises' time, would have been called marginal productivity theory. What do the producer goods do? They don't directly satisfy our desires or our goals, but they are physically capable of producing consumer goods or producing other producer goods that in turn can produce consumer goods. All right, so we can figure out physically or technologically what the marginal product is of a given or a particular unit of a producer good, and then we attribute the marginal utility of that consumer good to the producer good that can make it. It's like it's a technological claim on the consumer good. Okay? So that's how we value producer goods. And with all this stuff, you know, if there's a time lag, you take into account that element too. If you're looking at a bunch of grapes that you don't want to eat, but you know they're going to make a bottle of wine next year, the way you value them now is you're looking at that thing and saying that is effectively a bottle of wine that will be available to me in 1 year. And so how much significance do I attribute to that? Oh, well, then that's how much significance I attribute to these grapes and this glass and, you know, whatever else I need to make the bottle of wine. Okay, so we got that. And now Mises is saying, I'm going to show you some money. Here's some units of the money good in this community. Now we know, big picture, that fits into your single unitary preference ranking. But what principles or procedure do you use to attach significance to various units of money? Well, it doesn't directly satisfy your ends. Right, so you're not going to use the approach that you use with consumer goods. It also doesn't physically produce anything, so you're not going to use the marginal productivity approach, which is the way you value producer goods. So how the heck would you even value? Oh, you know what you do? You form an estimate of its purchasing power when you decide to spend that money. You look forward and you anticipate and say, when I go to market with these units of money, what am I likely to be able to buy in the marketplace with them? So what is its purchasing power going to be at that future time when I go to market with these units of money? And then what's the utility I attribute on the margin to those things that I'm likely to be able to acquire with this money? And then that's how I now attribute value or significance to these particular units of money right now. So that's what Mises means here when he's saying the laws that govern the value of money are different from the laws governing the value of consumer goods and the laws governing producer goods. And so he's just reiterating that's why really it's not a good idea. It doesn't make sense to have a twofold classification where you have to put all goods as either consumer goods or producer goods. It makes a lot more sense to have a threefold system. Consumer goods, producer goods, and media of exchange, because then you neatly can divide these various procedures of how do you actually specifically value these types of goods. You know, there's that qualitatively different approach that comes with money, and so that's why it makes sense to do it that way. And notice too, the threefold classification scheme is not consumer good, producer good, and money. Rather, it's consumer good, producer good, and media of exchange. Not even medium, but media, plural. Because strictly speaking, that third approach I just showed you there isn't just restricted to money. That's how you would value any medium of exchange. It doesn't have to be money. Because remember, money is just a medium of exchange that virtually everyone in the community accepts. So anything that is money is a medium of exchange, but you could have a medium of exchange or various media of exchange that aren't money, because only some people in the community would accept them in exchange, and other people wouldn't accept them. And so those things, they're media of exchange, because some people take them and trade, intending to trade them away again for something else. That's what makes them media of exchange. But if not everybody is willing to do that, then they're not money. All right, so the principles, if you said, okay, well, something's a medium of exchange, but it's not money, so how do I value that? Well, it would be, you would look at its purchasing power. You would say, go back to that example, I guess it would be in the first lecture, where I had that diagram from my principal's textbook, where the farmer, was it a farmer? He has eggs and tattered shoes, and so he wants to go to the cobbler to get the cobbler to repair his shoes, but the cobbler doesn't want eggs. The cobbler, I think, wants bacon, if I'm not getting mixed up. And so what does the guy do? So the farmer goes to the butcher and gives him the eggs for the bacon, and then goes over to the cobbler and gives him the bacon to get his shoes repaired. So there, if we ask, why was it that the farmer gave up his eggs for the bacon? It's an exchange. It's a voluntary exchange. So just looking at that exchange, what has to be true? It has to be true, just using the fundamental law of value, subjective value theory, it has to be true that, oh, to explain that exchange, we know that the butcher valued the eggs he received more highly than the bacon he gave up. Okay, that's fine. And we know that the farmer valued the bacon he received more than the eggs he gave up. That has to be true because it's a voluntary exchange. Okay. So that's fine. But now if we push it and say, but can we say anything more about why or how or what procedure the farmer used to value that bacon? Why was it that he placed that bacon higher on his preference ranking than he placed the eggs? Is it because the bacon was going to satisfy some, you know, inner urge that he had, maybe for hunger or whatever? And he said, no, that wasn't it. Oh, well, was it the marginal productivity of the bacon? Was he going to use it to produce whatever, a BLT when he got home? No. Okay, was he going to feed it to some animals or something, and then they were going to, you know, his horse was going to run faster, and so he was using it to produce more of the consumer good of pleasure riding on his horse? No, he wasn't going to use it for production at all. Well, then how the heck did he value that thing? Because he was anticipating, I can take this bacon and trade it to somebody else for his services in repairing my shoes. So there, the procedure he used to value that medium of exchange was to say, what is its likely purchasing power going to be in the future? And then I value this medium of exchange by attributing to it the value I give to the thing that I think it's going to get me, namely the shoe repair services. All right, so I'm walking through that pretty slowly. Probably a lot of you got that the first time I said it, but that's a critical point in what we're doing in this book. And that's later on, Mises himself is going to walk through that more slowly. So I'm giving you guys a little bit of a heads up so you don't get overwhelmed when he jumps into it. Okay, so now you're saying, that was a great controversy, but I want more. I want to have Mises answer some other question and quote a bunch of different economists back and forth. Okay. Is money capital? So that's the next issue. So Mises starts out, and I'm, again, to shorten the quotes, I'm putting some of this in brackets here, that he had a longer sentence or two before this, and I'm condensing it. So Mises says that, okay, now we've settled that issue, that money is not a production good. And we saw the reasons for doing that and how it kind of made sense in terms of our theoretical framework and in terms of just the elegance of economic theory. That it would be, it's more satisfactory as theorists if our classification scheme allows us to neatly assign goods into categories where we have a different types of explanations for valuation in those respective categories. And so, again, that was why Mises thought it really makes sense to have a threefold scheme rather than a twofold one. Okay. And Mises now says in this next issue of Is Money Capital, hey, you know what? That conclusion we just reached in the last section, that money isn't a producer good or isn't a production good, that's going to help us on this issue as well that economists have been arguing about. So that our conclusion that money is not a production good, now I'm reading the quote here, will help us to answer the question whether money is capital or not. This question in its turn is not an end in itself, but it provides a check upon the answer to a further problem concerning the relations between the equilibrium rate of interest and the money rate of interest, which will be dealt with in the third part of this book. Okay, so again, the fact that I copied and pasted that into a PowerPoint slide, you know, uh-oh, Murphy thinks this is important, so let me tell you what's going on here. So again, this is really fascinating to see. This is sort of like, I don't know if you guys are familiar with the Stephen King novel Misery. They also made a movie about it, where there's a, in the story, there's a best-selling novelist who I think writes thrillers or something, and he gets into a car accident, and this lady takes him in, you know, to nurse him back to health, but she's crazy. And she's like his biggest fan kind of deal, but she doesn't want to let him escape. And so in the course of that novel, the protagonist, you know, the author who's like sort of this lady's prisoner, he teaches her and then you as the reader of Stephen King's book a lot about how a novelist writes a novel. Because, you know, think about it, that's kind of amazing. The guy creates a whole world and has all these characters that have their life history. And, you know, just how does the author do that? Like, does he type up biographies for every character and have that on his hard drive, or, you know what I mean? Or, you know what I mean? How does he make sure there's no contradictions in the stuff he says about what happened to this guy in 1957 and how old this guy was when he graduated from high school and how old his dad was at that time? You see what I'm saying? So it's kind of a cool book. If you've never read it, it's interesting if you like that kind of stuff with crazy women who hold men hostage in their house. So where am I going with this? I forgot myself for a second. Now I remember. Mises, in a sense, is doing something like that here. We really get to look behind and see how does the mature Mises, you know, when you read Human Action, you almost just get the sense that Mises descended from the heavens and is telling us this is the way you should think about economics. But obviously Mises had to figure that out. You know, he didn't just come out of the brow of Zeus knowing all that stuff. So here, you really do get, you know, Mises is telling you why we should come down this way on certain questions, and he's explaining. This passage right here that I just read to you, where he said, it provides a check upon the answer. That's really cool. What Mises is saying is, you know, I'm not sure. I have one train of thought on this issue of the relations between the equilibrium rate of interest and the money rate of interest, but I could have been wrong with that particular train of argument. And so the fact that my conclusion from that route, which I'm going to go over in part three of this book with you, the reader, just remember at that time, back here with this stuff we're doing right now, we'd get the same answer. So what I'm going to tell you in part three is consistent with these issues here that I'm resolving, and so that kind of reassures us that we're on the right track here. Because I'm disagreeing with Bumbavrk, I'm disagreeing with some of the great thinkers here in this path that I'm blazing, but the fact that I'm the way I'm answering these questions of classification and terminology, and it's all mutually reinforcing. Whereas if you look at what Bumbavrk did, he comes down on one issue one way, but then it kind of contradicts the way he answers a different question. In tonight's lecture, I'm not going to touch on that, but when you're reading this chapter, if that's the kind of thing that interests you, just look out for it. Mises will say, it might even just be in a footnote, I don't remember. But Mises at one point says, you know, Bumbavrk says this, but, you know, which in and of itself is a plausible thing to say. I think he's wrong, but okay, it's a defensible argument. But then notice later on in his book, but Maverick says this. And those two things can't be simultaneously true. And so Mises is saying, that's another reason that I think what I'm doing here is Mises is better than what Maverick did, because the way I'm coming down on these issues, on these controversies, is all internally consistent, whereas these other great thinkers, they make plausible arguments on any one issue, but their arguments contradict each other if you look at their whole system at the same time. Okay, so that's partly what's going on here. Okay, so hang on, let me look ahead in the slides, because I can't remember if I explained the stuff about the money rate of interest. No, I didn't. Okay, so I'll do it here. Okay, so we're still on this opening slide, is money capital, this section. Okay. We're not going to get into this too much, but I want to sort of till the soil so that later when Mises comes at you, guns blazing, you aren't overwhelmed. To mix metaphors there. So what is he talking about? The relation between the equilibrium rate of interest and the money rate of interest. That's going to be the business cycle theory. And he keeps saying that we're going to do this in part three of the book. That's going to be where he goes over what we now know of as Austrian business cycle theory. So the money rate of interest is what we mean by the nominal rate of interest, or just the contractual market rate of interest, that when the banks expand fiduciary media, when there's now more money that the banks, in a sense, create out of thin air to lend, even though there hasn't been more gold discovered or anything like that, and that pushes down interest rates, the interest rate that we're talking about is the money rate of interest. All right, so that's what Mises means by that phrase in this context. The equilibrium rate of interest for Mises in this context means there's various ways you could describe. You could call it the natural rate of interest. That's what a lot of Austrians mean by that phrase. What he means is the rate of interest that would prevail if there weren't disturbances coming from the money side of things. So if the rate of interest that the banks charge were consistent with the actual state of the various quantities of capital goods and consumers' intertemporal preferences, that sort of thing, then that's what Mises means here by the equilibrium rate of interest. Yeah, Danny Sanchez is adding that Mises calls it originary interest in human action. He does in certain parts, but let's be careful with that, because some people, like Bombaver, what he means by originary interest, and I think what Rothbard does too, is like the interest rate that you earn, like the markup between goods. So it's not that you're lending money out contractually. You're not giving someone $1,000 and getting $1,100. Instead, you're buying producer goods and then selling them. So remember, that can get screwed up when the money rate gets pushed down too. So I'm not saying you're wrong, Dan. I'm just saying it gets some of the ways that people use the phrase originary rate of interest would get screwed up when the banks inflate. The rate of return, or the markup spread between the various orders of goods, does get screwed up when there's an unsustainable boom in progress. So there's that issue. So I'm just saying we got to be. I'd have to go read Human Action again real carefully. So you're right. When he talks about originary interest and relates to time preference and everything, you're totally right. He does use that phrase. But I'm just saying, if you think originary interest means, the spread between factors of production and then the thing they're going to produce in the next period, well, that also gets screwed up, because that's going to be equal to the money rate. Okay. If you're new to this and you're just like, whoa, you lost me three sentences ago, don't worry about it. The big picture here is, where are we going with this? Austrian business cycle theory is going to say when the banks inflate, they create more money it's called fiduciary media. It's unbacked money, and they lend it out. And so the market rate of interest, the money rate of interest, the nominal rate of interest, the contractual rate on loans gets pushed below what it previously was. And so if there was an equilibrium in the sense that the real forces were balanced in terms of how much, you know, physical savings is there in people that are desired to postpone consumption over time, those two things diverge. The money rate now no longer equals the equilibrium rate, and that's what sets in motion the unsustainable boom. Okay, so that's what Mises is talking about here. And so to relate it to this quote now, to say, is money capital? I'm not positive of this. I think what Mises means is, so to give you the quick answer, Mises is going to say money is part of private capital, but it's not part of social capital. So I think when he's saying that answer that I just gave you to this question of is money capital, and the answer is, well, yes, it's part of private capital, but not social capital, I think he's saying that's going to provide a check on our answer in part three. I think what he means is to say, because it's part of private capital, that means when the banks expand the money, individuals can think that they're richer, right? The banks expand money, so the banks have more to lend, and that makes specific individuals now, because they're getting that money, they're viewing it as part of their private capital, so they feel wealthier. But stepping back, we know society is not wealthier because we don't have more physical goods. And so it's that discrepancy now that's going to screw things up. During the boom, people feel wealthier than they really are. Because it can't be that everyone feels wealthier and yet society is the same. That doesn't make any sense. If everybody felt wealthier, then society would be wealthier. You know, or if everyone were wealthier, society would be wealthier. So I think that's kind of what Mises is getting at here, that the fact that his answer to the question is money capital is different based on whether you're looking at just one person or looking at everybody. I think that's a clue as to this is what's screwy with money, and this is why we even have the possibility of a business cycle. Okay, so I just kind of said something that I had never thought of before, so let me say that again in different words. It's a good thing we're taping this. All right, so, and this all ties together with everything we've done in this lecture so far. Mises is saying money, there's something special about money, technically about medium of exchange, but I'll just say money. There's something special about it. On the one hand, it is indispensable for a modern industrial economy. We need to have money in order to have economic calculation to arrange or to coordinate production activities. But on the other hand, there's something odd about money. Unlike anything else that we use in our productive activities, money per se is not necessary for the production process. It's almost like a mental tool to help us organize things, but the money commodity itself isn't physically necessary the way we need everything else to be necessary. Okay. And so that's the laws governing the valuation of money are also different. They're different from how we value consumer goods. They're different from how we value producer goods. So money is this its own thing, or media of exchange are their own thing. And they have their own special laws of valuation. Okay. And now there's another thing that's special about money, is that if we increase the quantity of money, the people who happen to be holding it, they certainly feel richer or wealthier. It allows them to go acquire more goods that they value. So that really raises their standard of living. And yet, the mere addition of more money per se can't possibly make society wealthier. Whereas, that's not true for consumer or producer goods. If I start giving John more tomatoes, he feels wealthier. His standard of living has gone up. And society is richer. So it's true, somebody who is a tomato seller, he could be hurt by me giving John more tomatoes. So make sure you realize that. But the point is, society on net, in the aggregate, if you will, is richer because of more tomatoes. So the point is, yeah, adding more consumer goods or producer goods can make certain individuals worse off, but we know that gains to everybody else have to more than compensate for that. In contrast, if I give more units of money to a person, that person's definitely better, but his gains are exactly counterbalanced by the losses to others. If we're just, you know, if prices are perfectly flexible and we don't worry about the coordination getting screwed up. Okay, so that's thing. And if you're not seeing that, it's real simple. Because again, when we define wealth, it is in terms of the tangible material goods that we have. And if somebody asked this question last class at the, you know, at the end, it was a great question, and it's good because now I'm drawn on that answer. When we talk about the material wealth of a society, you know, we're not talking about subjective things because you can't add that up. It doesn't make sense to say, is society richer in terms of people's subjective happiness? It's not that, oh, we can't know. It's that that doesn't even make sense, ultimately. But what we can say is if a tomato, if, you know, Martians come and give some guy 100 tomatoes, is society wealthier? Yeah, you know how much wealthier it is? By 100 tomatoes. You see? So it's true that some other people might be worse off in terms of their purchasing power gauge in some way, but necessarily their losses are less than the gain to the guy who got the 100 tomatoes. Okay. But that's not true of money, because if we don't worry about the introduction of new money screwing up people's ability to use the real resources they already have, and just, you know, if Martians show up and just dump a bunch more gold into the economy, all that will do is raise the prices written on the stickers in terms of how many gold ounces do things cost. Now, there'll be distributional effects. The people who happen to get the gold first are going to win, and the other people are going to lose. But the point is, they're just going to redistribute the other physical stuff that's getting made. Okay, so now, because of that, that opens up the possibility of something weird where you can have a business cycle, you can have an unsustainable boom, you can have a situation where people falsely believe they're wealthier when they're really not. Namely, if Martians do show up and start dumping money into the economy, that might make the people getting it feel wealthier, and if there's a lag between, you know, when prices adjust specifically, if that pushes down the money rate of interest below the equilibrium rate of interest, then that can set in motion the unsustainable boom. All right, so that last part that I said there, I mean, Mises, I don't think ever comes out and says what I just said there, but I think that that's consistent with what he's doing. He's really trying to, in this chapter, carve out and show us why money is a very special thing and should have its own place in economic theory, because it's got these strange properties where it's indispensable for a modern economy, and yet the more of it we have, we're not wealthier. In fact, to suddenly introduce bursts of it, at least if it's done through the banks expanding fiduciary media, that can screw things up and set in motion an unsustainable boom. Okay. Let's keep going. All right, I already answered this. The yes and no slide, I already went over this stuff. That's what I just talked about. Specifically, why does Mises say money is part of private capital? Because he uses, basically, he relies on von Bobrick's definitions of these two terms. So private capital, or what's also called acquisitive capital, von Bobrick defined, and I'm paraphrasing here, as goods which allow you to acquire other goods. So from that definition, money is clearly part of private capital, just like, and that makes sense. This accords with the approach of the lawyer or of the business person. Right? If you have a business, a day of a laundromat, and I say, how much capital do you have in your business? What people are going to think is that I mean, what's the monetary value of all the assets your business owns minus the monetary value of all your liabilities, and then whatever's left is the capital that's in your business. And if you, you know, turn up an accounting profit year after year, you would divide that by the capital, and you say that's the rate of return on the capital that I've got invested in this thing, right? So when I start listing my business assets, it says, oh, well, there's that, I got those dryers over there that cost me, or have a market price if I liquidated them right now of 100 gold ounces, and I've got those washing machines that have market value of 50 gold ounces, so that's 150. And I've got these things, you know, those machines that dispense the detergent, and I start listing off all the stuff. And then I say, oh, and my business, you know, in the register, I have 10 gold ounces worth of coins because the customers sometimes need change. You know, they'll come in and use a big, have a big bank note, and the little dispenser only takes little tiny amounts of silver coins, so the customer needs change, and so that's, you know, I have an employee who stands there when the thing's open with the safe and the cash register, and they, you know, so at any given time my business also has as part of its assets money, the actual money, you know, actual coins, gold coins. Well, clearly that's part of my business's capital. You know, if somebody else had a different type of business where they had to have a lot of money on hand, clearly they're going to count that as part of their capital, because when ultimately, you know, the definition, when you say to your accountant, what's my net worth right now, what that really means in practice is, if I sold off all of my assets for money, how much money would I have after I paid off everybody else that I owe, in terms of how much money do I owe? So clearly, if what you're doing to answer the question, how much capital or what's my net worth right now, if you're trying to figure out how much, when all is said and done, what pile of money would you have left over if you terminated the business, well, then clearly, if the business right now happened to have some money on hand, that's part of the capital, because what you're doing is you're turning everything into a pile of money. So clearly, the money you started with is going to end up in that pile. All right, so Mises is saying, clearly, when we say, is money capital, if we mean private capital, yeah. From the perspective of an individual household or enterprise, sure. But now if we ask from society's perspective, is money part of capital? The answer is clearly no. And there, Bombaver defined it, again, I'm paraphrasing, saying social capital, I think another term he used was productive capital, is the collection of goods that allows for the production of more goods. And so Mises is saying, so incidentally, just be careful, I'm almost positive that Bombaver said, yes, money is both private capital and social capital. But Mises says that's because Bombaver erroneously, in my Mises' opinion, classified money as part of social capital, or sorry, as a producer good. So then it has to be part of social capital. But I, Mises, deny that money is a producer good. And so that's why I, Mises, using Bombaver's definition of what social capital is, declare that money does not satisfy that definition, so money is not a part of social capital. Okay, so like I said, it gets really nuanced, but that's what's going on here. So why is that important? Because, again, so where Mises is coming from is to say, yeah, if you're the individual laundromat, the individual business person or household, the more units of money you have in your possession, the wealthier you are, and somebody asks you what's your net worth, how much capital do you have? Yeah, of course, if you have units of money, that's going to count. Money's the most liquid asset there is. That's great. You got money. You know, if there's a business that's in trouble and you come in and say, well, gee, how much cash do you have on hand? You hope that that's a big number. They're going to tell you. But if there's a whole society that's in trouble, if there's people starving, and I come in as the policy advisor, I might say stuff like, well, gee, how much grain do you have in the silos? Do you have any packages from the Red Cross? Do you have? I'm not going to say how many kilograms or ounces of gold do you have in circulation to deal with this famine. I mean, technically it could if you're going to use it to import food from abroad, but even there, that's because you're, selling it. You know what I'm saying? But the planet as a whole, how much money we have doesn't help us solve economic problems, which is funny because, of course, that's the solution now that for Europe and everything. Oh, we just got to print more money. So these things that the Mises is saying is truisms, nobody or major economists don't believe anymore. But anyway, that's the distinction. So a society is richer if it has more railroads, if it has more guns, if it has more food, if it has more buildings, if it has more tractors. Society is not richer if it has more money. Okay. We've got 19 minutes left. This time I won't cut the lecture short twice like I did last week. So let's see, how do I want to use that? I think I'm just going to go through and maybe just save a little bit of time at the end for maybe one or two questions, because this stuff is pretty fundamental. And I don't think I'm wasting time here. I mean, this stuff is important. So this slide, I wasn't sure how much time I wanted to devote to, but let me devote at least a few minutes. So right now, for those people who are listening later, I'm talking about the slide, the Austrian approach to capital and interest theory. You don't need it so much to get the main points in this particular chapter, but there's only a small part where Mises, Mises just assumes the reader knows this stuff. Everybody's read Bombavik, right? And so you would just get a little bit lost, but you could take away most of what's going on in this chapter. However, there's no way you can get through this book, and there's no way you're going to understand the business cycle part unless you understand the Austrian approach to capital and interest theory. So at some point, you have to buckle down and suck it up and just learn this. So I'll give you a little taste of it right now. I would strongly recommend that you read this article that I've got, embedded here in the PowerPoint slide when you get a chance. Because there, for Mises Daily, I wrote this stuff up for someone who had never heard of it before. So I think that's a pretty good introductory piece. So it's not mandatory for the class, but if you don't know what's in that article, you're going to not have a chance, put it that way. So there you go. Okay, so what's the big picture? Bombavik, again, I think I've said this before, but let me reiterate. Bombavik's great contribution, the way I like to think about what he did, is he took Menger's pioneering subjective value approach. Menger really invented Austrian economics and developed subjective value theory, thinking about goods right now, right, in a static this time period framework is kind of how Menger developed subjective value theory, talking about people who have preferences and they exchange and how prices get formed, that kind of stuff. Even Menger's development of the theory of money and the origin of money, it did involve time, but only in the sense of, I have a good that's not very marketable. If I see someone who has a more marketable good that I actually don't want for myself, but I know it's more marketable, then I might trade, intending to trade it away again in the future. So, yeah, there's a time element there, but that's qualitatively different from the stuff when we ask how is it that people earn interest on capital. Okay, so really what Bombavik did is he took the Mengerian subjective value framework and he applied it in an intertemporal context, intertemporal being a fancy word meaning across time periods. So the way Bombavik explained the phenomenon of interest, right? Why is it that a capitalist, someone who has command of capital goods, which in a private setting would include money, right? So why is it that someone who has 1,000 money units can, in a sense, put it to work and derive a perpetual income stream off of that. Right? If you're a capitalist and you have 1,000 money units, you have 1,000 units of the money commodity. Let's say it's gold. Let's say you got 1,000 gold coins. As long as you don't invest it foolishly, you can take that 1,000 gold coins and invest it, lend it out, you know, buy a bank CD, do whatever, and just live off interest. And so in a sense, it's like that 1,000 gold coins just starts throwing off a perpetual stream of income for them forever. And that's what we call interest income. So what the heck is going on there? How does that work? Because, and this is, and Mises gets into this stuff in this chapter, he's saying, or maybe it's the next chapter, I'm getting mixed up now. Because on the one hand, that's kind of weird, money is barren, right? If you had 1,000 apple seeds, then you can understand, oh, gee, how is it that year after year I can keep eating apples and I never run out? That's weird. You say, oh, well, it's because of the physical productivity. That an apple seed physically creates apples in the future in which there are more apple seeds, and as long as you don't eat too many and you don't, you know, do something dumb, like dump chemicals on the field or something, there's not a drought, there's not a bunch of locusts. But if you husband it properly and you don't have a bunch of bad luck, those apple seeds you start out with can last forever and generate more apples and you know, provide a perpetual stream of apple consumption and enough seed that you can, you know, not diminish your capital, if you will. So that is the metaphor that people used when it came to explaining the apparent fecundity of money. Oh, so if I have 1,000 gold coins, how is it that I can, you know, if the interest rate's 5%, why is it that every year I can consume 50 gold coins worth of consumption goods? And my 1,000 gold coins capital stock remains intact. How is that possible? Well, it seems obvious. Oh, because capital is productive. Right? You can buy the apples, you know, take the gold coins, go buy the apple seeds, and that creates more apples in the future. So, duh, that's why. Or you go and you use the gold coins to go buy a tractor. And then you can harvest more crops with the tractor than without. And, you know, that's just the physical fact of the world. So there you go. What end of story? We just explained it. What's the next question? But Bobrick said, whoa, whoa, whoa. That doesn't make any sense. What you just did is you explained to me why somebody would attach a value to apple seeds today. The fact that apple seeds will generate apples and seeds next year explains why I would pay gold coins for them now. But let's say next year the physical thing these apple seeds are going to produce next year, let's say they're going to produce whatever, 5,000 apples. And at that point next year, if I took those 5,000 apples, I could sell them on the marketplace for 1,050 gold coins. Okay. But Bobrick is saying, why right now, today, looking forward at that outcome, how come the market price of my apple seeds that are going to produce that isn't 1,050 gold coins? Why instead is it only 1,000 gold coins? How come I can buy these apple seeds for 1,000 gold coins today, put them in the ground, wait a year, then take the apples they physically produce and sell them for 1,050 gold coins so that I've earned 5% interest on my capital, my financial capital? Why is that possible? So you see, Bhambhavrik is saying, don't talk to me about the physical properties of apple seeds and how they physically produce stuff in the future. That's irrelevant. We'll stipulate that. Okay, great. You give me a handful of apple seeds, they're going to produce that many apples next year, and we think I'm going to sell them for 1,050 gold coins, fine. Right now, what determines the market's valuation in gold coins of those apple seeds? And your answer to that pins down what the interest rate is. If the answer is 1,050, the interest rate is zero. If the answer is 1,075, then the interest rate is negative. I'm losing financial capital on the deal? And if the answer is 1,000, oh, all of a sudden the interest rate's 5%. So see, so Bobrick is saying the interest problem is one of the valuation of factors of production. It has nothing to do with productivity per se. You need to know what the productivity is, what those technological relationships are, for you even think about the issue sensibly. But once you have those physical facts under your belt, now the question is, how does the market value the factors of production? And that determines what the implicit interest rate is. Okay, so that's von Bobrick's approach, and his answer is to say, for whatever reasons, and he gets into reasons that we won't get into, present goods are more valuable subjectively than future goods. So right now, if somebody says to me, I'll give you apples right now, or I'll give you a claim that allows you to collect an apple a year from now, which do you prefer? The market price of the present apple is going to be higher than just the claim on the same apple available in a year. And Bobrick, it's that phenomenon that then drives the apparent undervaluation of the factors of production relative to what they're ultimately going to yield in the future in terms of consumer goods. All right, so what's happening there is von Bobrick is using Mengerian subjective value theory, and he's just applying it to present versus future goods and then coming up with that differentiation. Okay, so with that background, now Mises' quick little asides in this chapter will make more sense to you. And I spelled it out even more in that Mises Daily, but we'll run out of time, so let me move on. Okay, the enemies of money. If you don't know who these pictures are, this top left one is the Thomas More, the author of Utopia, and Mises kind of takes some umbrage, I guess, in Utopia. He more took pot shots at gold and silver. And the middle one is Aldrich, the senator who was instrumental in the creation of the Federal Reserve. And, of course, you know who Ben Bernanke is. Okay. Mises says that money under socialism is the slide we're on here. Okay, Mises, this is an important point here. Mises says, do not think of money as a claim ticket that gives you a proportional share in the total output of society in a given time period. That's the way a lot of people think about money. And Mises, don't think about it like that, because that's not what money is. Money is not a claim. We can imagine a socialist society where the workers, you know, based on how many hours they put in, maybe they're weighted, like maybe brain surgeons get more tickets per hour than somebody else. And so, you know, the workers all put in their time, and then they get paid tickets according to some certain formula. And then, you know, maybe the socialist overseers could say, okay, and now we have this big pile of consumer goods that we just, you know, that we all collectively produced this year, or, you know, this day or this week, whatever. And we issued a total of 3 billion tickets. So there's this much output. So that much output divided by 3 billion tells you how much one ticket gives you. And now you guys are free to go ahead and claim your share of the total output. So that's, you could imagine that, when Mises says that's not money, those tickets would not be money. Because there, if the amount of the consumer goods, if that pile of stuff got cut in half for some reason, like maybe there was a disaster, a fire in the warehouse, now all of a sudden every worker's ticket only gets them half as much stuff. Just because it's a simple, you know, division calculation. But in the market economy, it's not necessarily true that if half of the available quantities of goods disappeared, that all of a sudden the purchasing power of money would fall in half. In reality, it might be different. And so understanding that is the key to seeing why money really isn't a claim on output. Right, because so money, this is important in why I didn't want to, I thought it'd be confusing if you thought about money as a fiat Federal Reserve note or as a fiat European Central Bank note, because those things look like they're claims. But money, the money commodity, is not a claim on anything. So in a society where gold is money and you have a gold coin that's 1 ounce of gold, there's nobody who owes you anything. You can't go up to somebody and say, "Oh, because I worked last week and I got paid this gold coin, that means you owe me something, man. This is like my, you know, it's like society is now indebted to me because of the labor I put in, and this is how I get square." Mises said, "That's, do not think of it like that. That's wrong. Money is a good in and of itself. When you sell your labor, you got paid right then. You got paid money. End of story, you're done." Now, it's true, and this is where the subtlety is, you accepted that gold coin because you thought it was going to have purchasing power, but the point is that is fundamentally different. That's not a that was not an intertemporal transaction. That wasn't a credit transaction. It's not like you said to your neighbor, "Hey, I'll mow your lawn today, but next week when I have to go to a movie, I want you to babysit my kids." Then your labor that you did last week, you know, made someone indebted to you, and then when the guy performs the service later on, he's paying off the debt. That's true. But if you go to your neighbor and say, "I'll mow your lawn for a gold coin," and then next week you're planning on paying the neighbor a gold coin to watch your kid, he can say no, and he's not breaking any contracts. Okay, so money, again, is not a claim. Okay, unfortunately, I'm just looking at the clock here because I have to end right on time. I'm probably not going to get to your questions, so I will answer your guys' questions by tomorrow. I'll make that promise to you. I'll put it on my calendar and everything. But we only got 3 minutes, and because David Gordon's right after this, I can't go long. Okay. Now Mises does say if a socialist state, you know, it's socialism, so they nationalize the means of production. They own all the factories and the tractors and 18-wheelers and the drill presses and the hammers and the nails. But if they allow their citizens, once they go into the state stores and get their goods and what have you, the consumer goods, if now the authorities say, "Yes, you can trade them among yourselves if you want. You can't own producer goods, because if you did, then we wouldn't have true socialism. But you know, we allow a limited private ownership of final consumption goods, and yeah, you can trade them if you want to." Mises says that money would develop then in that limited capacity, because you still then would have the problems, the inefficiencies of direct exchange, and so media of exchange would develop, and eventually, assuming the authorities, you know, didn't crack down on it, one good or more would outstrip the others and become money. Okay, last slide for tonight. Monetary cranks. So this is a good phrase or term that it's kind of like when economists want to say, "You know, this person's so stupid, we don't really need to take him seriously because he's just not even." You know, that's what economists use. So I've often called Scott Sumner a crank. He thinks it's funny. I think it's funny too. Because what are the monetary cranks? They're people who just think that what's wrong with society is either there's not enough money or we shouldn't be using money, or, you know, they think there's a quick fix, that there's something about money, you know, it's not scarcity that makes society bad, it's something with the monetary system. So traditionally, a lot of monetary cranks were just rampant inflationists and just thought, you know, there's various levels of sophistication. The crudest monetary crank would just say, "Well, man, if you know, in our times, if Ben Bernanke just created $1 million for everybody on Earth and just handed $1 million to everybody, we'd all be rich. So why doesn't he do that? What a jerk," right? I mean, that's the most naive form of monetary crankishness, which I think Scott Sumner is only one degree removed from that. But, you know, there's different levels of it. So like, in the arguments over the free silver movement, you know, a lot of people thought you know, the William Jennings Bryan's famous Cross of Gold speech, they thought the gold standard was impoverishing the farmers, and that if we allowed for the free coinage of silver, that that would, you know, help the farmers get higher prices for their products and pay off their debts, blah, 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 right? So there's different levels of sophistication, but a monetary crank just kind of means somebody who has a harebrained scheme for changing the monetary system to then, you know, eliminate all these social ills. Okay, last point, and I'll stop, is Mises says, what's interesting is a certain type of what he considers to be a monetary crank thinks that all we need is to have an elastic credit system, and then that would solve all these problems. And Mises says, what's funny is the, you know, practical business people and the statesmen correctly and thankfully reject that. And I guess this is what Mises was writing in 1912. But actually, he said, they have no reason to do that. That what these cranks, these who propose an elastic credit system is the solution to all of our social ills, at least in terms of economic problems, what they are saying is the logical outcome of the prevailing views on money. So Mises is saying, basically, I'm going to set them all straight. I'm going to be the one in this book who definitively blows up these bad theories which have spawned these calls for an elastic credit system that the theorists kind of shy away from, but they don't realize that's the logical implication of their system. Whereas I'm going to say, I'm going to give you a theoretical framework that shows specifically what's wrong with these people calling for an elastic credit system. That in other words, we don't just have to say, well, that goes too far. Mises can show, no, this is specifically what's wrong with it. This is theoretically why it's wrong. Whereas the other people couldn't really stop it. It's sort of like, to give an analogy, people who think the minimum wage ought to be raised 50 cents an hour, if you said to them, oh, okay, so let's raise the minimum wage to $1,000 an hour and all the poor people will be rich, most advocates of the first thing will say, well, no, that would be pushing it too far. And they wouldn't actually propose making a minimum wage of $1,000 an hour because their common sense would kick in and they would know that can't be right. But yet, they still think, oh, but making the minimum wage $8 an hour is probably good, or $9 an hour is probably good. And so Mises is saying that he's doing something similar here. He's going to show a consistent theoretical framework in which we can reject the crazy crank calls for massive inflation through an elastic currency that's consistent, whereas these other people really, they have no leg to stand on because their own theory says that, yeah, that should be a good idea. Okay, I got to stop there, clean the room out for David Gordon's class. I will, I promise, get to your pending questions by tomorrow. And if you're taking the class for credit, obviously look for the quizzes that will go live on this Friday. Stop the recording.